up, I'll call on you. But first, we have the second lecture, and I remind you, the third lecture is tomorrow evening, so don't miss that either.
Thank you very much, Christopher. It's a real honor now to be associated with the Robbins lecture and to get to meet the Robbins family. We certainly don't need any reminders of the relevance of terrorism, but the terrorist attack that took place in Samarra in Iraq today on Golden Mosque certainly is a reminder that this topic is quite relevant and pressing. What I want to do today is talk about the macro evidence, more at the society or country level. Tomorrow I'll talk about consequences of terrorism. The outline for tonight's lecture is I'm going to begin by talking about data that the U.S. government collects on international terrorism. One of the things one quickly discovers in this field is that there's a burning need for better data on the frequency and lethality of terrorist activity. I'll tell an entertaining but sad story about how the government bungled putting together the most authoritative data that the U.S. government assembles on terrorism. Then I'll analyze the imperfect data that's available. And then lastly, I'll talk about some new evidence on foreign insurgents in Iraq. Also, Richard suggested I repeat this from last lecture. The main papers that I'm drawing these lectures from are available on my webpage in case you would like to follow up. And my webpage is there at the bottom, www.kruger.princeton.edu. It took me about 6 months to get permission from the university to be able to use my name in a Princeton web address. So proud that I was able to do that. Let me begin by giving you a little bit of background on the data that the U.S. government collects on terrorism. And I think if there is an area for, you know, kind of a priority area, is to assemble better data on the occurrence of terrorist attacks. It's kind of mind-boggling to me that we could launch a war on terrorism without any thought of how we would measure how we're doing in that war, or without any thought about how we would report to the citizenry whether our dollars are well spent, whether we're making progress, or whether we're actually hurting our cause. The most authoritative data that are available, at least in the United States, and I should emphasize most authoritative unclassified data, are from a report that the U.S. Congress has mandated the State Department to prepare, which is called Patterns of Global Terrorism. This report has been mandated since the early 1980s. The Secretary of State is required to report to Congress on significant terrorist attacks, organizations that are involved, any support they receive from foreign nations. And the Act spells out a definition of terrorism, which I'll review with you. The term terrorism means premeditated, politically motivated violence perpetrated against non-combatant targets by subnational groups or clandestine agents, usually intended to influence an audience. The term international terrorism means terrorism involving citizens or the territory of more than one country. Now, this definition, of course, leaves out terrorism perpetrated by a state. And as I said last night, I wouldn't say that there's no such thing as state terrorism, but this looks at sub-state organizations or individual actors. The U.S. government amended this definition to include non-combatants, or to define non-combatants as, in addition to civilians, military personnel who at the time of the incident are unarmed or are not on duty. We also consider as acts of terrorism attacks on military installations or on armed military personnel when a state of military hostilities does not exist at the site. And this was amended, actually, I believe, because they wanted to include the bombing of the Khobar Towers in Lebanon. Personally, I would have stuck with the original definition and you'll see with some of the data that I use, I am able to make some adjustments. Now, this report, Patterns of Global Terrorism, has an appendix, Appendix A, which lists each significant terrorist attack. And my reading of the Act is that the Secretary of State is required to provide this list. And you can go through this list, and you can classify where the attacks took place, which organizations were responsible, where the perpetrators were from, who they were targeting, and so on. And you can also verify whether the attacks took place and try to collect additional information. And I went through the reports for the years 1997 to 2002 in the paper that I published in the Journal of Economic Perspectives. And I've extended that through 2003, and I'll show you some of those findings. The body of the report has a whole bunch of glossy figures, glossy charts, which I'll show you one in a moment, which it might have been a mistake to hand out the the future slides that I'm going to get to. Anyway, the text of the report has these beautiful charts which list each year the total number of terrorist attacks, including the ones that are insignificant. And I was browsing through the 2004 report when it came out. The report for the year 2003 came out on April 29th, 2004, and I noticed a disconnect which seemed to have been exacerbated in this year, but you could even pick up in the previous few years, which if you look at the body of the report, the total number of terrorist attacks occurring each year has been declining since the year 2000. So you can see it's down from 426 in 2000 to 190 in 2003. Yet if you count up the number of significant attacks listed in the appendix, they were actually rising. And the appendix looks like the following. This is the appendix from the year 2003, where for each day that a terrorist attack occurred, the appendix lists where it occurred, what happened, who was injured, did someone claim responsibility, and so on. And in the report that was released on April 29, 2004, the number of significant terrorist attacks was at its highest level since the reports began in 1982. Yet, when the report was released, the State Department claimed that the number of attacks was at its lowest level since they started collecting data. And they further said that this shows we're prevailing in the war against terrorism. And when you look through the report, you see a lot of anomalies. Let me give you an example. This appendix is supposed to cover the entire calendar year. And if you flip to the end, it ends on November 11th. Now, of course, November 11th is not the end of the calendar year. You might say, well, maybe there weren't terrorist attacks after November 11th, but in fact, that's not the case. November 15th, there were two terrorist attacks in Turkey on temples. A few days after that, there was a major terrorist bombing in Saudi Arabia. So I came across these anomalies, and I called up the State Department to ask what's going on. Perhaps there was just a printing error, and these significant attacks were included in these glossy figures, which say total number of attacks, but they were just omitted here at the end. I left several messages, and I never received a return phone call from the State Department. So together with David Layton, a political scientist at Stanford, we wrote an op-ed, which was published in the Washington Post on May 17th, 2004, where we accused the State Department of manipulating the data. Now, that charge actually was awfully strong, and I think maybe I don't regret that I wrote it, but I think maybe knowing what I know now, manipulation is not the right word. Incompetence is a better word. So when we went through the report, what we discovered was that the number of significant terrorist acts increased from 124 in 2001 to 169 in 2003, even using the data that ended November 11th, which missed additional attacks. And that was the highest number since the data were first collected. And we gave a copy of our op-ed before it was published. It was an interesting story. I called up the editor of the editorial page at the Washington Post, and I said, would you be interested in this? And he said, well, I can't tell until I've read it, but I'd certainly consider it. So we sent them an op-ed on May 1st, and they held it for 17 days. I thought, this is really breaking news in the middle of the war on terrorism, and we're saying the government is misleading us. The government was misleading us on how successful we had been. Why did they hold us for so long? Well, they had many op-eds to run on Abu Ghraib, which were breaking at the time. So the op-ed came out on May 17th, and I was expecting when it was published that we'll get a response from the State Department, that other journalists would follow up, and absolutely nothing happened for 3 weeks. It was really appalling to me that this was the number one or two issue in the U.S. election at the time, that there was so little attention being paid to the kinds of information the government was giving out and what turned out to be inaccurate information. Then, on June 10th, Richard Boucher, who was the spokesman at the State Department, held a press conference, and he said that they've discovered errors in the report. They're going to issue a corrected version. It may take 8 pages to list all the corrections. The number of fatalities will end up being a lot higher than they initially said. They were off by 50%. And he had the following quote, which I thought was interesting, ironic. The claims we made were based on the facts we had at the time. The facts turned out to be wrong. Which was almost the same line that was used on weapons of mass destruction. So the spokesman made this comment, and then shortly afterwards, Colin Powell went on Meet the Press. And I'm going to show you a little bit of a clip from that.
From NBC News in Washington, this is Meet the Press with Tim Russert.
Into this report on global terrorism, your credibility being called into question, this is your Deputy Secretary of State, Richard Armitage, in April.
Indeed, you will find in these pages clear evidence that we are prevailing in the fight.
In the fight on terrorism, and the report says this, there were 190 acts of international terrorism in 2003, a slight decrease from the 198 attacks that occurred in 2002, a drop off of 45% from the level in 2001 of 346 attacks. The figures in 2003 represents the lowest annual total of international terrorist attacks since 1969. And then two professors from Princeton took a look at this, and from Stanford, and they concluded this. Yet a careful review of the report and underlying data supports the opposite conclusion. The number of significant terrorist acts increased from 124 in 01 to 169 in 03 at 36%, even using the State Department's official standards. The only verifiable information in the annual reports indicates that the number of terrorist events has risen each year since 2001. In 2003, it reached its highest level in more than 20 years. Henry Waxman, the Democratic congressman from California, said that you are manipulating data for political purposes.
Well, we're not. The data that is in our report is incorrect. If you read the narrative of the report, it makes it clear that the war on terror is a difficult one and that we're pursuing it with all the means at our disposal. But something happened in the data collection, and we're getting to the bottom of it. Teams have been working for the last several days and all weekend long. And I'll be having a meeting in the department tomorrow with CIA, other contributing agencies, the Terrorist Threat Information Center, and my own staff to find out how these numbers got into the report. Some cutoff dates were shifted from the way it was done in the past. There's nothing political about it. It was a data collection and reporting error. And we'll get to the bottom of it, and we'll issue a corrected report. And I've talked to Congressman Waxman.
Was it CIA data?
It's a combination of data that flows in, and some of it is CIA. The Terrorist Threat Information Center compiles data, provides it to us. But when you look at it in hindsight now, and you look at the analysis given to me by Congressman Waxman and these two congressmen, all sorts of alarm bells should have gone off. All sorts of, as I say to my staff, circuit breakers should have dropped when we saw this data, and they didn't. But I don't think there was anything political or policy-driven about it. It was just data that was incorrect or wasn't properly measured compared to the way it was measured in previous years. And so what we have to do is normalize the data this past year, 2003, in the same way that we normalized data in previous years, and we will be putting out that corrected information as fast as we can.
But it is embarrassing.
Very embarrassing. I'm not a happy camper over this. We were wrong.
You know, you take this report on terrorism, and the last time you were here...
I should stop it there. He went on to ask him about weapons of mass destruction. After Colin Powell went on Meet the Press, the issue got quite a bit more attention. I discovered that students that I had at Princeton learned about it from watching a show called Comedy Central. And since some of you might not be familiar with Comedy Central, I thought I'd show you just briefly this snippet. And I learned that Jon Stewart, who is the host of Comedy Central, is really brilliant. And I do this with some reluctance because I'm going to have to follow him in a moment. But this is from Comedy Central.
June 14th, 2004. Comedy Central's World News Headquarters in New York. This is The Daily Show with Jon Stewart.
Let's begin tonight with some good news in the war on terror. 2 months ago, the State Department released its survey of worldwide terrorist acts in 2003, and it turns out the number of such acts was at its lowest level since 1969. At the time, Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage drew the only logical conclusion.
You will find in these pages clear evidence that we are prevailing in the fight.
You see that, people? Stop focusing on events outside in the world and start looking at these pages. You'll find that if you look at the pages, we're doing quite well. Counterterrorism coordinator Kofor Black, do we have the terrorists on the ropes?
They are truly under catastrophic stress. They're very defensive.
Booyah! In your face, Bin Laden! We are taking you down! Wait, I'm sorry, I'm being told that's all completely wrong. I'm sorry. Yes, as it turns out, the government now acknowledges the terrorism report was badly flawed and grossly undercounted the number of attacks last year, which in reality was among the bloodiest years ever for terrorism. Oops. Among the report's omissions, three huge bombings, one in Saudi Arabia and two in Turkey, which weren't included because, this is true, they took place in November. After the report apparently needed to go to the printers. Apparently our government is run by the same people who put out your high school yearbook. So it's just great too. The report is so strewn with mistakes, a State Department official says the corrections may fill 8 pages. California Congressman Henry Waxman, who condemned the report when it was released, has now stepped up his criticism.
The report was based on inaccurate information, and they drew political conclusions that were self-serving for the administration.
You know, they've kind of been doing that for a while now. It's getting ridiculous. Boy, who's the poor sucker who's got to get out there and defend this one?
But it is embarrassing.
Very embarrassing. I'm not a happy camper.
Did you hear what he said? He said, don't clap for Colin Powell. So Tim Russert says it is embarrassing. Colin Powell said it is embarrassing. And you may have missed the quote. He said, I'm not a happy camper. And you know, ever since this war began, it seems like Colin Powell has had a very poor camp experience. I'd be very surprised to see him come back next summer to this camp. But Powell insists there was no evil intention.
There was no attempt to mislead or cook the books in any way. So far, it appears to be an honest administrative error.
Honest error. 8 pages of corrections. The first page or two? Honest errors. Third page, perhaps a questionable half-truth. By page 6, you're f***ing lying. You're lying. And the State Department has announced it will soon release...
Okay, so, as I said, Jon Stewart is a tough act to follow. Jon Stewart was not entirely accurate. He said what... Actually, I had heard from the State Department that the reason why the chronology stopped on November 11th was it had to go to the printers. That turned out actually to be false. The problems were caused by the fact that the government assigned this a very low priority, and the State Department was not particularly interested in checking the numbers over. And we discovered quite a bit, and Colin Powell was pretty helpful, actually, in explaining to the public and Congressman Waxman's staff informed me what goes into the report and how it's prepared. The State Department requested the CIA to produce numbers on the number of significant terrorist attacks and the total number of attacks each year. And then the State Department wrote a narrative which was whatever it wanted to say, kind of independent of the numbers. So it's kind of amazing to hear Colin Powell say the narrative was just fine. We have to change the numbers where they're used in the narrative, but the narrative was just fine. So it was kind of data-free, even though the statistics were reported in the narrative. And I learned something about the way the U.S. State Department kind of thinks about data. They're helpful for public relations, public diplomacy, but not really for finding out something objective, which to an economist is what you use data for. So it was kind of an eye-opener. What had happened was President Bush created something called the Terrorism Threat Integration Center, TTIC. He made a big announcement in the State of the Union address, I think in 2002, that he was creating the TTIC to integrate all of the information in the U.S. government on terrorism. And I suspect what happened is that the Central Intelligence Agency said, well, let's just throw everything into the TTIC that we don't really want to do ourselves. And this was probably high on their list. And the person who had been responsible for running the computer program, putting together these data, actually had left the CIA at this time, and they hired a couple of contractors. I've been trying to find out who the contractors were, because I have my suspicion it might have been Halliburton. But I haven't been able to uncover that part yet. And to hear Kofor Black, who was the aide you saw there, describe what went wrong with the computer program was really quite enlightening, because it became clear that he never touched a computer in his life. And, you know, he talked about how you have to enter things precisely in one part of the program to have it spill over to another part. And nobody checked the numbers over. I mean, the amazing thing is they kind of wrote what they wanted. They published this information in the back of the report. And the report doesn't give that much information. It says that there's an incident review panel, the U.S. government incident review panel, which reviews each terrorist attack and determines whether it was significant. They didn't say what their criteria are. They didn't say where they get their information from. They didn't say what basis they use for deciding whether an incident is significant. So we were able to uncover all of that. And the panel was composed of people who seemed kind of reasonable, but they rotated quite quickly, so there was not much institutional memory. And in an attempt to be constructive, David Layton and I wrote a piece for Foreign Affairs, which the journal gave the brilliant title, Misunderestimating Terrorism, to our article. And what we suggested is that the State Department try to learn from economic statistics. And there have been attempts in U.S. history, particularly by President Nixon, to manipulate economic statistics. And in fact, Richard Nixon requested, and you can hear this in the transcripts, it's quite amazing, that employees be transferred from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, who he thought were spinning the numbers, when in fact he was spinning the numbers. And after that, there were procedures that were adopted which restrict the ability of political appointees, including the president, of political officials, from commenting on the data before the career staff who have prepared the data have a chance to present them and interpret them. So we made a series of recommendations in this article, such as that there be a clear and consistent definition of terrorism, that the data be verifiable. The chronology is verifiable. The glossy charts in the body of the report, which show terrorism coming down to its lowest level ever, are not verifiable. You have no idea what goes in them. What we subsequently discovered, which is truly remarkable, the reason for that sharp trend in those charts is because there were a large number of attacks on pipelines in Colombia, on oil pipelines in Colombia. It was subsequently determined that they were probably carried out by the oil pipeline repair company. You probably don't want to include, and this is in the hundreds. So they were just dropped precipitously without any explanation. So clearly those are not very informative charts. And you don't know that because you don't have verifiable information here. My colleague Paul Krugman wrote a piece in the New York Times about this incident after Meet the Press. He called me up. I remember he called me up and he said, you know, he was really looking for the evil intent. And I said, Paul, I just think it was incompetence. And I actually think that's worse. Because, first of all, if you were going to manipulate the data, you would actually fill it out so it actually reached the end of the year. That's kind of transparent that it just stops November 11th. And undercounting by 50% the number of fatalities, it was really the Keystone Cops. It was just incompetence. And Paul wrote this up in the New York Times, and he said, Professor Krueger is a forgiving soul, because I was willing to give them the benefit of the doubt. But he pointed out something which we also said, which is that had the mistakes gone in the other direction, they would have been caught. Had the mistakes shown that 2003 had a much higher amount of terrorism than previous years, which it actually did have, they would have double-checked the numbers. So in this piece that David Layton and I wrote for Foreign Affairs, we call this asymmetric vetting, that they only vetted the numbers, they would have vetted the numbers had they not supported the position that they wanted to take. We also recommended that career professionals be the ones who release the data, not the Deputy Secretary of State. We also suggested, this was an eye-opener to me, the State Department is the only cabinet department in the U.S. government that does not have a statistical agency. The Education Department has a statistical agency. The Labor Department has one. The Commerce Department has two. Agriculture Department has very well-funded statistical agency, not the State Department. So when they release numbers, there's really nobody in the building who knows whether there is a statistically significant change. They don't know whether the trends they're looking at could have occurred by chance. So it's kind of mind-boggling to me. So I propose, especially when, you know, the first Secretary of State in the U.S. government was Thomas Jefferson, who was a huge fan of statistics. So we made these recommendations. I sent a copy to Colin Powell, and I didn't receive an acknowledgment. And the Inspector General of the State Department issued a report on this incident where he made many recommendations which echoed what we had proposed. He didn't propose a statistical agency, but he did propose that they hire someone who has some statistics training to work on the report. He also went one step further than us, which was interesting, which is some of the decisions, and I'll show you this a little later on, seem a bit inconsistent. The way Chechnya is handled is inconsistent. And they couldn't reconstruct why sometimes they considered it a terrorist attack, an international one, and sometimes they thought it was domestic. But on the face of it, it kind of looked like the same. So the Inspector General proposed that they keep minutes of their meetings so that they could actually go back and reconstruct how they made their decisions, which I thought was a very good idea. So what happened? You may be wondering what happened. Well, Colin Powell didn't return to the administration. Condoleezza Rice became Secretary of State, and one of the first acts that she took was to cut out the statistics from the report. So I say goodbye, Appendix A. And they did this in a very heavy-handed way, I think. They could have avoided some controversy. They looked at the report for 2004, at the statistics for 2004, and the numbers were extremely high. Amount of terrorist activity was very high. And they said, we don't think we should be responsible for releasing these numbers. They're put together by the National Counterterrorism Center, the NCTC, which is a successor, by the way, to the Terrorism Threat Integration Center. That organization was closed down. And there was a new organization called the National Counterterrorism Center. And they should be responsible for releasing these data, which I think you can actually make a case that they should be responsible for the data. They collect them, after all. But we have this funny situation now where the most important public report on terrorism is completely uninformed, at least doesn't release the statistics. So it's kind of free to make any claims that it wants. The National Counterterrorism Center, I think, has been quite even-handed in releasing the data and much more explicit in describing what they do. And they want to do a good job. They actually asked me for a copy of John Stewart's tape to show their analysts what might happen if they screwed things up. So at one level, I have some reason for optimism that the situation may get better. Okay, so let me describe a little bit about what I've done with these data now that I've shot them down. Well, the State Department did issue a corrected list, and using the corrected list, I extended the data from 1997 to 2003. And I readily acknowledge that these data have serious problems. And what I tried to do is to take each terrorist event that occurred, and there were almost 1,000 that were included in the database in this period, and to code up who the perpetrators were, who the target was, and to link that with information on GDP per capita in the home country, in the target country, measures of political rights and civil rights, information about the religion in the country, the size of the country, and so on. And you end up with very, very rich data. I mean, it's a shame that the data are not more accurate. But in principle, what you have is for each pair of countries, each possible pair of countries, information on the number of terrorist attacks perpetrated by people from country A against people in country B. I've been using these data to estimate a series of statistical models. So I can describe the data to you in a little bit more detail, and then I'll give you some of the main findings. And fear not, I won't show you too many of the negative binomial estimates. So we have 956 events that occurred from 1997 to 2003. There are now a number of data sets on international terrorism. I've done a little bit of comparison among them, and I would say none of them is certainly none of them is perfect, and many of them are seriously flawed. And it's very unfortunate that there's not an organization that provides more respectable data. I'll also show you a little bit of evidence on suicide attacks, and here we have information on what we think is the universe of suicide bombings or other kinds of suicide attacks, including both international and domestic events. There are some issues with the data that we've coded up. For example, embassies are not an infrequent target. What we did was to code the place where the attack occurred, where the embassy was located, as the country where the embassy was located. And the target we made, the country that owned the embassy, seemed reasonable to us. There are a large number of terrorist attacks that occurred in India, 280. The largest number were in Kashmir. And it's kind of strange the way the State Department codes, reports them. Presumably, they believe they're carried out, if they're international, they're carried out by Pakistanis or some foreigners. The second largest group was from Colombia. And some of those are also questionable. I mentioned the business with the oil pipelines, which are mostly not in the data set. But there are some others which you might think are kidnappings for ransom, which I would consider more crime than terrorism. So those were excluded in what we did. And the State Department has a lot of trouble of what to do with Israel, because West Bank and Gaza Strip over most of this period is not an independent entity. It's under Israeli control. So they treat most of those as domestic. Now, you do have a large number of events in Israel, but that would be because a tourist from America was actually in the crossfire or was injured or killed in the attack. So those are problematic. We end up dropping them from our data set. So let me tell you a little bit about the data. By the way, this gives me a little bit of confidence in the data. One of the alternative data sets is called the Iterate data, which was collected by many, there are many people who were involved, but Todd Sandler is the person who I think is most directly responsible for the data. And we compared our data to the Iterate data, and we could probably do this in some other ways, but the Iterate data here were just tabulated at the country level where the event occurred. And if you look at the correlation between our data and the Iterate data across countries, if you look at the first row, which has all countries, the correlation's reasonably high. It's around 0.57, 0.52. You'd hope it would be 1. On the other hand, it's not 0. The data were not tabulated by who the target was. The way we defined the target was who were the people who were most affected, the largest number of those injured. Because a cafe could be blown up, and there might be 7 Israelis and 2 Americans there. We would code that up as the Israelis were the target, which seemed reasonable. If it was the American Colony Hotel and there were all Americans who were there, then we would code up in that case as the Americans as being the target. There's some ambiguity about how you do this. The correlation is lower if we do it at the target level. Interestingly, and this is good news, if we exclude India, which I mentioned is kind of an outlier in the State Department data, the correlation rises considerably, up to around 0.9. So what that suggests is, with the exception of India, the two data sets are really pointing in the same direction. The Iterate data has about 18% more events in it. It counts more terrorist attacks, so that's potentially something of an issue. You can't read this. This shows you country by country. And we've sorted the data here by the number of attacks, but the far right column is the number of events or attacks per million people in the country. So India, obviously, is a big country, and if you look, it's an outlier in terms of the number of attacks, but it's not such an outlier if you make it on a per capita basis. It's only slightly above the world average if you do it that way. And you can see the West Bank and Gaza Strip really stand out, as does Yemen and Colombia. Angola, Sierra Leone, those are the highest countries in this table. We could also look and say, the way we've coded the data, what percent of the time or what fraction of the time is the place where the event occurred the same country where the perpetrators are from. And interestingly, that's 88% of the time. So I like to say most international terrorism is local. Most of the events in this database are events where there was some terrorist attack that was carried out by residents of a country and property of a foreign country, like a McDonald's, or people from a foreign country were in the crosshairs. Sometimes they were the main target. Sometimes they were just kind of collateral damage. About half the time, the way we've coded the data, the target and the origin are the same. About half the time, the place where it occurred and the target are the same. You know, so the model you should have in your mind, or the example you should have in your mind, is not September 11th, where people from one country came over to the United States, or people from a few countries came to the United States, committed a heinous terrorist attack. That's kind of the outlier. The more typical case is something like Daniel Pearl. Daniel Pearl was the Wall Street Journal reporter who was kidnapped and then murdered in Pakistan by a group that was believed affiliated with Al-Qaeda. That's the more typical kind of event that's in this database. Okay, so some other kind of initial findings from tabulating the data. In about two-thirds of the cases, it was suspected that a terrorist organization was involved. So most of the time, there's a specific organization that's suspected. Even in the other one-third, there may have been organizations that just wasn't clear who they were. 91% of the time, the attacks were carried out by multiple perpetrators. We coded up, this was my co-author David Layton's work, because he's more of an expert on each of the individual incidents. We made a judgment as to whether the perpetrators and the victims were of the same religion or a different religion. 62% of the time, there was a difference in the religion between the victims and the perpetrator. Now you might say, is that high or is that low? So I calculated the following rather interesting statistic. If you were randomly to pluck two people from the planet, you know, 2 out of 6 billion people on Earth, what's the chance that they would have a different religion? And the answer is 77%. So it's not too different than what you would find if you were to just randomly select people. On the other hand, I mentioned earlier that I think most of the terrorism that is occurring is local. So suppose you did this within country, this calculation. So you took each country and said, what's the chance that two randomly selected people from each of the countries on Earth are from a different religion? There you would get 27% for the average country. So it looks like, and I think these are really interesting numbers. I'm not entirely sure what to infer from them. It looks like there is probably higher than random difference, you know, higher than you would expect from random chance. You're finding a difference in the religion between the perpetrators and the victims. Interestingly, if you do this for suicide attacks, 90% of the time, the victims and the perpetrators are of a different religion. So something about suicide attacks seems to be more closely connected with the religious differences. About 4% of the attacks were on embassies. 12% of the attacks in the State Department's data targeted the U.S., as we defined it. 7% were on international organizations. And what was interesting about this is that, you know, there was a real shock when the United Nations was targeted in Iraq. But it's not so uncommon for the United Nations or the Red Cross or for other international organizations to be a target. And then just 5% of the attacks were suicide bombings. This table, which you could read over at your leisure, breaks down each of the events by the origin or the target. And then we calculated rates, I think these are per million people, by different quartiles of GDP. And you can see there in brackets there is a p-value, which is can we reject randomness? If the p-value is small, then it looks like the pattern that you're seeing probably did not occur by chance. If the p-value is high, then you couldn't reject that these differences are chance. So for example, when we look at these data on the left, which has all of the events, on the right it's just the suicide attacks, it looks like the pattern by income is pretty much income of the origin of the perpetrators is pretty much random. We can't reject chance. On the other hand, the targets, the victims, are much more likely to come from wealthier countries. You see the same thing for the targets of the suicide attacks, although the origin of the suicide attacks are more likely to actually be wealthier countries. The next rows show you by GDP growth, where we don't see a difference, at least for the origin. We don't see a statistical difference for the origin, although we do for the targets. literacy, where we don't see differences again by the origin. Then we divided countries based on their civil liberties, using a measure from the Freedom House Index, and also based on political rights, and I'll say a little bit more about those variables later on. We also break things down by the predominant religion in the country of origin of the perpetrators or in the country of the targets. When we do this by origin, we don't see a difference by religion. We don't see a statistical difference. Predominantly Muslim countries are overrepresented in this sample, but you couldn't reject chance as the explanation for that. And that finding is something which I'll come back to. We see that again when we estimate a more sophisticated statistical model. Mountainous terrain, this is a variable I was really interested in, because there's been a lot of research on insurgencies and whether mountainous terrain makes it easier for insurgents to kind of retreat and go by undetected and provide a safe haven. Yet we don't see any connection between mountainous terrain and the origin of terrorism, or also for the targets. So let me say a little bit more about the statistical models. Don't be intimidated by this equation. For those of you who like econometrics, what we did was we estimated negative binomial models, count models, where we had pairs of countries, over 11,000 pairs, and we tried to predict the number of attacks going from country I to country J from a set of variables. And most of the pairs of countries that you look at, there is zero incidence. You know, there haven't been any terrorist attacks in this period, thankfully, from the United States against Canada. And that's true of most of the pairs that you would find in the data set. And this is the type of statistical model that could be used in that situation. And we've tried some other more sophisticated models as well. And I think this is an area where it would be worthwhile to try, you know, more sophisticated econometrics. On the other hand, given the weaknesses of the data, maybe it's not worth pushing the data too far. So what we did in our data set is we dropped Israel and the West Bank and Gaza Strip because of inconsistencies in the way the data were coded. Attacks in Kashmir, we assigned Pakistan as the origin in most of the cases. We dropped events that occurred along the diagonal. So that means we would have coded it as domestic terrorism. And the reason for doing that is the data set explicitly excludes domestic terrorism. If it looks to us like it was domestic terrorism, we thought since we were omitting other incidents of domestic terrorism, we should exclude that as well. We restricted the sample to countries that had at least 1 million people. And that gave us 149 countries, or 11,000 pairs of countries that we could look at. So let me go into a little bit of detail on the findings. First, we found that the income of the target country mattered. The positive sign here indicates that richer countries are more likely to be victims, or more likely to be targets of terrorism. And that's true if you drop the United States from this data set. One might have the concern that this was collected by the U.S. State Department. Maybe they're a little bit more sensitive when it's Americans who are victims, so maybe it's not representative. For that reason, so if we drop the United States, we get the same pattern. We don't find any effect of the income of the origin country. And I can show you this in a kind of interesting chart, and this is the kind of thing you could do with these data. So we divided countries up into quartiles, fourths of the distribution of income per capita. And this chart just initially shows you for the poorest one-quarter of countries based on country of origin, who were the targets of terrorist attacks. And what you could see is that the richest countries, the top quartile of countries, were more likely to be targeted. Okay. We could do that for all of the quartiles. And two things to observe here. First, when you look within each of these quartiles, based on the income of the origin country, the perpetrators, you see that they're skewed towards wealthy targets. The blue bar on the right, the dark blue bar, is the tallest in each of these four cases. And if you just looked at the general height of the bars, you don't see the lowest income countries being more likely to be origins, perpetrators of terrorism. They seem to come across the board. That, I think, is consistent with the main finding that we saw yesterday when we look at the individual characteristics of people who participate in terrorism. They tend to be middle class or upper middle class or higher income groups, and they're not necessarily drawn from poor countries. It seems kind of random based on the GDP of the country that they're coming from. But they do seem to be targeting wealthier countries. We also looked by civil rights. And here I should say, some of the literature kind of argues that political rights are important. We've focused more on civil liberties. Political rights and civil liberties, as they're coded up, are very highly correlated. We use Freedom House Index, which is a group which Eleanor Roosevelt was part of when it was started. They code up various countries based on the number of civil liberties and political rights. The civil liberties measure includes freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, and independent judiciary. The two variables, political rights and civil liberties, are very highly correlated, and it's very difficult to distinguish between the two. To the extent we can distinguish between the two of them, the data that we've looked at, and I'll show you a little bit more on this too, suggests that the civil liberties are more important than political rights, although I'd be hard-pressed to separate the two since they tend to go hand in hand. So what do we see here? The origin countries tend to be countries with low level of civil liberties. The bars on the left, which is looking at the origin countries for countries with low level of civil liberties, like Saudi Arabia, as an example, tend to be more likely to be origin countries. Countries with a high level of civil liberties are less likely to be origin countries for the perpetrators of terrorist attacks. Within each of these groups, it looks like the countries with the higher level of civil liberties are a little bit more likely to be targeted, but that's not an overwhelming effect, but we do find an impact in that direction. Okay, we also looked at GDP growth as opposed to the level of GDP, because maybe what's important is whether a country is growing or shrinking, not the absolute level of income. There we found somewhat mixed results, but if you look from 1990 to 96, which is kind of the immediate period before the period that we're looking at, we find no significant impact and quantitatively small effect of civil liberty of GDP growth. Population matters. Both the population of the origin country and the population of the target country. And this is not only due to India. If you drop India from the analysis, you find the same type of pattern. Volume of trade. I put some effort into getting data on trade flows between country pairs. Ruined the summer for a graduate student to assemble these data for me. And I had high hopes that this would be an argument for more open trade policy. And the results were kind of mixed. This is why you see a negative sign. So that says if there's a higher volume of trade, there's a lower likelihood of having a terrorist incident between those pairs of countries. On the other hand, I made it kind of light gray because it wasn't always statistically significant. And most importantly, if we control for the distance between countries, because distance has a very big impact on the volume of trade, that tends to knock out the effect of trade. So the trade flows might just be standing in for the distance between the countries. The distance result is really interesting to me because I think that reinforces the point I made earlier that most terrorism is local. Distance seems to be a big barrier when it comes to terrorism. It's as if the transaction costs appear high because of distance. And that's true, I think, within countries and also across countries. We looked at the literacy rate, including the female literacy rate in particular, and that didn't have a significant effect. I mentioned the results on religion. So bear in mind what we're doing is we're looking at the affiliation with various religions in the countries, not in this case looking at the perpetrators. So if a country has a high fraction of Muslims or high fractions of Christians, how does that affect their likelihood of being a perpetrator for terrorism and of people from that country being a perpetrator of terrorism? And there we find no significant differences across religions. So what I take away from this is that there are many reasons that people can have grievances. Religion is one of them. It's not the only one. And people from various religions have had grievances. So even though the world is focused on Islamic terrorist organizations now, they're by no means the only source of terrorism. Then I created a variable which is kind of related to some comments last night about what about imperial countries that occupy other countries. So I thought of the same thing myself. So I thought, well, maybe what we're seeing is largely a response to occupation. So I looked for data on whether country A is occupying country B. Turns out there aren't too many occupations in the world. It's kind of a positive thing. So what I did instead was I said, for each country, do they occupy any other country? And then I also said, for each country, is it occupied by another country? So it wasn't specific to the... Bless you. Wasn't specific to the pairs.
I've never had that ringtone from a mobile phone before. First time for everything. Continue, please.
Is everyone okay? Okay. Anyway, what did I find? This wasn't specific to the pairs because there just was not enough data because there aren't that many occupations taking place. But anyway, countries that occupy other countries are more likely to be targets of terrorism. And countries that are occupied are a bit more likely to be perpetrators of terrorism, but that was not an overwhelmingly strong result. One of the things which gives me a little bit more confidence in this research is that other work that's used other data sets finds, to a large extent, I think, a similar pattern. James Piazza, who used the same data set, but he coded it up himself and also looked at casualties as well as the incidents of terrorist attacks, found no effect of poverty, unemployment, or economic growth. A recent paper by Alberto Abadi, which used a rating of terrorism risk from an insurance company. I think it was an insurance company. It was intended for insurance purposes. Found the same kind of pattern. Let me describe a little bit what he found. Well, here's a quote. Terrorist risk is not significantly higher for poorer countries once the effects of political freedom are taken into account. Abadi focused on political freedoms using the same index, using the Freedom House Index, rather than civil liberties. He also emphasized a result that I'm not so sure is robust. He argued that there's a nonlinear effect, kind of a not quite U-shaped, but it kind of curves down a bit. So an upside-down U, if you will, that when you start from a very low base of political freedom, of you start from totalitarianism, and you move towards democracy, you may see a period where terrorism increases, but then you reach a certain point and you see that more political freedoms cause terrorism to decline. The reason why, and most countries are on that declining portion, and the reason why I guess I wasn't convinced that this result is so robust is when you plot out the relationship, it doesn't look all that nonlinear to my eye, and there hasn't been a test to see if the countries at the highest level of political freedom are actually any different. So it's not obvious to me it's such a robust result. And as I said earlier, in the data, the correlation between the political freedoms and the civil liberties is extremely high. It's 0.96 with these data. So it's very difficult to distinguish between the two variables. These results are different than what one finds if one looks at the occurrence of civil war. If you use the same kind of statistical models to say, is there a civil war in a country? Lower income countries are more likely to experience a civil war. So these results do look like they're different from civil war. Now the data, as I mentioned, are quite weak. So I could point to studies that use a lot of different weak data sets. And I think it's fair to, if you're skeptical, to remain skeptical. It shouldn't nudge you too far, I think, in changing your views. But I think the literature does point in this direction. And let me switch gears and talk a little bit about Iraq. So this is work that I've started not too long ago, and I should tell you, I mentioned to my brother-in-law I was doing some research on the nationality of foreign fighters in Iraq. And my brother-in-law, who is a Republican, said, "Oh, you mean the Americans?" And that's not quite what I've been doing. What I've been looking at is information provided by the U.S. military on the identity or the nationality of captured foreign insurgents. So the data were provided in a press release, which you can get on the web. You can actually see a transcript of it, by Major General Rick Lynch. And in response to some reporters' questions or previous questions, he prepared this slide, which shows you the number of terrorists, or I wouldn't use the word terrorists, number of insurgents who were captured in Iraq from April of 2005 to October of 2005. The total number was 311. For the year, it says 376, and they haven't provided this breakdown for the 376. You can only get it for the 311, as far as I'm aware. And you may say, well, how are these data collected? Oh, but by the way, I don't know if you can read it. Britain has an entry of two. So two of the insurgents who the coalition forces say were captured in Iraq were from Great Britain. U.S. had one. The largest number came from Egypt, then Syria, then the Sudan, then Saudi Arabia. Okay, so how were they identified? Well, Major General Lynch was asked this, and he said they're identified in terms of questions we ask them, interrogations we do, papers that they might have on them. But with authority, we can say that they came from those countries. I don't know how accurate these data are, to be honest. They are, I think, the best unclassified data that's available. They come from the multinational forces intelligence reports and the multinational coalition, multinational corps, that's what MC. I have a student who's on leave from the military. She explained to me what MNFI and MNCI stand for. These are reports that the intelligence officers fill out. So what do we do with these data? What I've been doing is to take the Middle East, North Africa, and Europe, 81 countries in all, and try to say, well, where are the foreign nationals who are being captured in Iraq coming from? 26 countries in total seem to be the country of origin for the foreign nationals who were captured in Iraq. And you might think this is a pretty broad universe to include Europe and so on. So another thing I did was just to limit the sample to 47 countries that were in that were located within 3,000 kilometers of Baghdad. And you know, why is this important? And I kind of go back and forth about how important it is. One is, I guess I believe that Iraq has become a magnet for people who are upset with the U.S., a magnet and also created a supply, people to be upset with the coalition forces. The U.S. government thinks it's important because they think that a large part of the insurgency is coming from foreigners. I have some real skepticism about that. I don't think it's unusual for a military campaign to try to delegitimize the opponent and to say that, well, look, this is just being perpetrated by foreigners. The Iraqis actually like us. These are just foreigners who are coming in and blowing up mosques and so on. Is one way to delegitimize the opposition, which is mostly indigenous. It's mostly Iraqis. And the U.S. government admits that they're mostly Iraqis. So then the fallback position is to say that the people who are doing the most heinous crimes, most heinous attacks, are foreigners. So this is what General Lynch said. We believe that a major piece, not numerically, but in terms of the effects of their attacks, of the insurgencies is terrorists and foreign fighters. We believe that they're coming, a majority of them come from Syria through the Euphrates River, valley into Iraq. Since April of this year, we've captured 311. So what I've done is the same kind of statistical analysis, negative binomial estimates to try to look at the characteristics of the countries that the foreign nationals are coming from to see if we could see some kind of pattern. And what was really quite striking to me is the pattern looks just like what I showed you when I looked at the international terrorism incidents. This shows you some of the coefficients. You can look at them at your leisure if you like. But what I found is that the population seems to matter. Larger countries are more likely to be countries of origins for the foreign nationals who were captured. Closer countries, distance to Baghdad, has a very big effect in these models. GDP per capita actually has a positive effect, so wealthier countries are more likely to be countries of origin for the foreign nationals. That seems to contradict the view that people who are joining the insurgency are coming from lower income countries. Literacy was not statistically significant. I used a measure of inequality, the Gini coefficient, was not a significant predictor. So it's not only higher income countries, it's not necessarily more unequal higher income countries. Infant mortality. Countries that have a higher infant mortality rate were less likely. Let me say that again. If a country had a higher infant mortality rate, they were less likely to be an origin country for the foreign insurgents in Iraq. That's kind of consistent with this perverse effect of GDP per capita. And the two were reasonably highly correlated, and it looked like infant mortality was a stronger predictor than GDP per capita. The results for civil liberties were just the same as what I found in the international terrorism results. Political rights, if you use them instead of civil liberties, also seem to matter. The foreign insurgents were coming from more totalitarian regimes. On the other hand, again, I found that the civil liberties looked like they were a little bit more powerful as a predictor. I looked at whether a country was a member of the coalition, which is a bit hard to define. The way I define coalition is that they had military personnel in Iraq at some point. And the people who were joining the insurgency, or at least being captured, which I suspect is representative of who joined, but I certainly don't know that, were not necessarily more likely to come from coalition forces. And I did find in these results, probably not so surprisingly, that they were more likely to come from countries with a higher percent of Muslims. So what does this lead me? I mean, one of the things I think which has kind of been underemphasized in the war on terrorism is the importance of civil liberties. The Bush administration has emphasized democracy, but you can have more civil liberties without occupying a country to impose democracy on it. So I wrote a piece in the New York Times in 2003 where I said that a lack of civil liberty seems to be a main cause of terrorism around the world. Support for civil liberty should be part of the arsenal in the war against terrorism, both at home and abroad. And I worry about the abridgment of civil liberties at home in the United States. Tony Blair actually made a somewhat similar point, so I was pleased to see that. He wrote, "The more people live under democracy, with human liberty intact, the less inclined they are their states will be to indulge terrorism or to engage in it. This may be open to debate, though personally I agree with it, but it emphatically puts defeating the causes of terrorism alongside defeating the terrorists." And I like this. Benjamin Franklin said about the same thing. This was a recent speech by Alberto Gonzalez, the Attorney General of the United States at Georgetown University. And there's some question about whether Ben Franklin actually penned this, although it appeared in his almanac. Those who would sacrifice liberty for security deserve neither. And one of the real concerns I have at home is that we could have this perverse effect by curtailing civil liberties. And I also worry about the way we're going about building democracy in Iraq. If the main goal is to try to build democracy to reduce terrorism, and it's not clear whether it's democracy or civil liberties, which often go hand in hand with democracy, you have the curtailment of civil liberties, abuses with Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib. Paul Bremer, when he was, I forget the exact title, but when he was in charge, if that's the right word, of the coalition in Iraq, or when he was responsible for rebuilding Iraq, he closed down the Al-Hawza newspaper, which was Muqtada al-Sadr's, the claim was that the newspaper had incited violence, so Bremer closed it down. It actually since has reopened. About 3 or 4 days after it was closed down, there were major incidences of revolt. Here's a picture from, I think it was 4 days later, 5 days later, of the burning of an American Humvee. On top of that, you also have the Lincoln Group, which is a group that the U.S. military, I believe it's the military, has been paying to plant stories in Iraqi newspapers, which seems to me to be kind of the opposite strategy of supporting civil liberties. So let me just kind of wrap up, and then I'll look forward to Christopher calling on you for questions. It seems to me we've been fighting almost a data-free war on terrorism. And one of the things which impressed me about Colin Powell is he really did want to get to the bottom of the problems. And I think military people are really interested in having some quantitative measures of whether they're succeeding or failing, trying to use that to have a better strategy. Both the micro data that I showed you yesterday and the more aggregated data, by and large, show no correlation between GDP per capita and the origins of terrorism. I should also caution you that just as we say correlation is not causality, the lack of correlation is not proof of the lack of causality either. There could be some other variables or simultaneous causality in some way which is obscuring relationships. But it seems to me that the burden of proof ought to shift to those who want to argue that income, economic conditions are an important cause of terrorism to provide some evidence of it. Civil liberties seem to me to matter quite a bit. It's possible that there's some indirect links between economic conditions. Wealthier countries are more likely to provide civil liberties and political freedoms. That's probably quite an indirect link when it comes to terrorism. As I said yesterday, I think terrorism should be viewed more as a violent political act than a response to economic conditions. And I think there are many reasons to improve education and reduce poverty around the world, but alas, reducing terrorism is probably not one of them. So why don't I pause at this point and entertain questions.
Right, we've got time for some questions. Who wants to ask? At the back there, yes. Just wait for the roving mic.
Professor, 2003 said in the New York Times that civil liberties are a cause of terrorism. But if one was to equate terrorism perhaps to intolerance, could you explain why you don't think that intolerance, in fact, leads to a lack of civil liberties in a country? Why it seems to be the other way around?
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure I understand your question, but I think of civil liberties as being... Lack of civil liberties is not inconsistent with intolerance. So, I think of civil liberties, the way they're defined here, as providing an alternative way of expressing one's views, an alternative way of dissenting, alternative to violence. So if you want to call that tolerance, I think that that's fine.
Sorry. No, I'm... My fault. But, I mean... terrorism, I think you could perhaps explain as extremism or intolerance. And if you did that, couldn't you see a relationship between a country that is naturally intolerant and one that doesn't have civil liberties, rather than running in the other direction of a country lacking civil liberties encouraging terrorism?
I see. One could argue that there is simultaneous causality. That the way I would probably tell the story is that if a country faced some terrorist risk, it might, like the U.S. is doing now, curtail civil liberties. So the direction of causality is backwards. And that is, I think that's a real concern here. I don't know of a good way of addressing it. I suspect that most of the variability in civil liberties is not resulting from response to terrorism, but I can't prove that for a fact. So I think that's a valid criticism of this conclusion.
We have a question up there. You haven't got your mic on.
Okay, what role do you see for political and sociological theory? I just noticed a new observation that lack of civil liberties is a cause of terrorism. You begin to enter more sort of theoretical terrain. And do you think current theory is lacking in an empirical content?
Gosh, I'm not sure I am expert enough to comment on that. I'm going to take the Fifth Amendment and say, I should stick more to what I know, so I really can't comment.
Another question up there.
Professor, according to your data from 1997 to 2003, there are 280 events happened in India. What the reason why it happened? Is caused by civil liberty or what kind of problem? Why so many? How you classify why it happened so many events in Kashmir? Because it's a political unrest or political problem, but doesn't mean civil liberty. It's similar or not? Can you tell me a little bit more? Thank you.
Yes. I think that a large number of those are perpetrated by Pakistanis. So I think one would want to link those events to the situation in Pakistan, which is not one of strong civil liberties or strong political rights. The second thing to point out is both Pakistan and India are very big countries. So when you scale them for the population size, it's a large number, but it's not nearly as big an outlier as it might seem, just because they're large countries.
There's one there.
Yeah, I was I was wondering if you extended the data set, I guess it starts in 1997. If you extend the data set, it seems like terrorism goes in waves. So if you were to go back a little further to, I guess, instances when the IRA was committing terrorist acts, or even farther, I guess the data doesn't exist, but, you know, to the Ergon or what have you, do you think it would change your conclusions or what you're getting at all? Because it seems like the, you know, selection of time you've chosen is very specific to this sort of Islamist terrorism, to these rebel, you know, groups, but it seems like terrorism constantly comes in these cycles and they change, and so it seems like you've chosen a very limited sample.
Well, a few things. The reason why I chose the period I did is I think the State Department data are more comprehensive starting then. If you go back to some of the early reports from the 80s, then I just have no idea what kind of resources they were putting into collecting the information. My guess is it would probably strengthen the conclusion about GDP per capita, that if you were to include some of the European terrorist groups or, you know, obviously wealthy countries. So I think that result, which is one I'm most interested in and I would probably emphasize the most, is would probably be stronger. The other point I would make is, as I said in the talk, it doesn't seem to me that religion is so important. You know, even in the period that I'm looking at, from 97 to 2003, I don't find that the predominantly Muslim countries are more likely to be suppliers of terrorists, to be origin countries of terrorists. So once you control for the other variables. So it's not clear to me that religion or kind of the current focus on Islamic terrorism is really coloring the conclusions that much in the data that I have.
Another question up there.
Do you have data on how many people died in these events? Because it would be very, very nice to have. Maybe it's just changes in technology. If you go a further distance, you try to kill many people at once. So maybe what you find is just changing of, say, the terrorism technology, not right. Real things.
That's a very good question. We do have data on the number of fatalities. I haven't used it. I haven't emphasized it because I think that adds randomness. You know, the example I would use is if you go back to the first attack on the World Trade Center, had the car bomb been moved a little bit to the left or the right, I forget which direction, the whole building might have come down. And you would have been talking about thousands and thousands of fatalities instead of a small number. So to some extent, I take the number of fatalities as largely, as reflecting a large random component. One could take the opposite view and say, well, there's more signal here because more sophisticated groups are going to have more success, even though there's a random component to it. There has been some work. I mentioned James Piazza's work, where he looked at the number of fatalities. The idea of looking at distance and the lethality of the attack is actually an interesting one. You would imagine that if you're going to bear the fixed cost, I suppose one can imagine if groups going to bear the fixed cost of trying to do something abroad, they're going to try harder or try to be more effective. One thing I would point out is that the State Department data, as well as other data that I'm aware of, shows that the terrorist attacks that are being committed are more lethal. So to the extent that there's been a change over time in the technology, it seems that the technology that's being used is more effective. And I think, I'm going to make this point tomorrow, so I might as well advertise tomorrow's lecture a little bit. When we think about the consequences of terrorism, I think we need to focus really on the more catastrophic type events. And perhaps what's caused the Bush administration to take the extreme measures that it's taken, you know, if I wanted to give them the benefit of the doubt, what I would say is they've seen this trend, and they see that the trajectory is not very good, so they want to try to preempt things before they get to this really dangerous part of the curve. I think the trend is steep, but it's starting still from, I'll say this tomorrow, from one level, a relatively low base. But that's something that you see in the data. You see that the likelihood of fatalities from attacks has risen, and the number per attack has risen.
A question down here.
Professor Kruger, are you satisfied with the State Department's definition of terrorism and non-combatants? Do you think it's inclusive enough? Does it leave important variables out? And will you in future extend your research to include state terrorism, which you pointed out in the beginning you had excluded?
Right. On the first part, the definition doesn't trouble me as much as the implementation of it. I think the definition I have in mind, which I used yesterday, would focus, would exclude the military. You know, I'd focus on civilians. And probably for political reasons, the State Department amended its definition. I don't think that changes the results very much. And using the data from the chronology, one could omit them if one wants. I think the bigger problem is in the inconsistency in which it's applied. A lot of the data originally come from newspaper reports and translations of newspapers from around the world. And on one hand, you could say, well, maybe the newspapers are incomplete. On the other hand, if the idea of terrorism is to spread fear, they want to reach the media. They want to get into the media. And you could say if it didn't get into the newspaper, it probably wasn't, you know, it didn't have that much of an impact on the population. Nevertheless, I worry about kind of the thoroughness of the way that the data were collected. State-perpetrated terrorism, I think that requires a very different type of analysis. And you're modeling the behavior of a government rather than of individuals or organizations. And to me, that just requires a different type of analysis, which I think I'm less adept at. So I think that's the kind of work that should be done. It's just not what I would consider to be my comparative advantage.
Yesterday you mentioned that the Hezbollah has a social wing, and it is well known that many groups around the world have very, very efficient social wings, so are very involved, highly involved in the charitable sector. And of course, such charities are more likely to be cooperating places with poor economic conditions. So my question is, do you have any, are you aware of any sort of evidence, quantitative evidence on such activities? I'm only aware of a few very interesting case studies, but do you have any sort of more aggregate or detailed data on such things, and what kind of insights you would add to your analysis?
Right. That's a good question. There's research by Ellie Berman, who has focused on kind of the social aspects of the terrorist organizations and kind of developing it more as a cult. Al-Qaeda doesn't operate that way, from what I can tell. You know, there's kind of the Hezbollah model, which Hamas seems to have followed, actually probably more effectively than Hezbollah, since they were elected to office. I don't know how representative they are, to be honest. I think you could still question, at one level with the analysis I showed you today, maybe what one would want to do is to say, are the terrorist organizations substituting for the lack of some safety net, or substituting for the lack of some public services which the government's not providing? So that's something that I could amend to include in my model, which would probably be interesting to do.
All right, question here.
Professor, what do you think is the importance of historical factors in determining incidents of terrorism, and is there some way of measuring such more historical factors? You alluded towards imperialism, perhaps other such one. And what do you think is the effect of mass media, or the role of mass media in terms of terrorism?
Right. Those are both good questions. I'd be quite confident that historical factors do matter, you know, either accurate perceptions of history or inaccurate ones. And many of the incidents of terrorism that we see arise from disputes that have existed for hundreds of years. So I think it's wrong to deny history, which may be why current economic conditions are really irrelevant. You know, you're kind of faced with long-standing resentments from things that happened decades ago in some situations, which have been kind of built on and blown out of proportion in some cases, or in some cases not. I don't know how to kind of get a good handle on that for the type of analysis that I do, but I think that that's something certainly worth considering. The second question about the media, many of the terrorist organizations are very media savvy. You know, my understanding, you can see this in Tom Friedman's book from Beirut to Jerusalem, where he describes how the terrorist organizations would try to commit the atrocities they do in the morning to make it into the news cycle. And they would hand out press releases, you know, and then they would be done for the day. So if you were in the media, I guess you would kind of know it's okay to go out in the afternoon. I actually had recommended that this conjecture that the terrorist acts are committed more likely in the morning, that we actually collect data on it. The State Department data said, I proposed this, that they add to it the time of the attack. Because I would love to see the diurnal cycle. That's the cycle over the 24-hour clock. And see if it does pile up in the morning. You know, that's exactly what happened on September 11th. That's also what happened July 7th here. May have been for other reasons, but I suspect that the media cycle is part of it. I also suspect that if the media, this is related to tomorrow's lecture, sensationalized less, terrorism would be less effective. Unfortunately, I think the incentives are for the media to try to draw on a wider audience. And as a result, some non-events get an enormous amount of attention. And that helps to amplify the fear, which makes terrorism more effective. That's the way I would think about the role of the media. But it's not something which, you know, other than those few anecdotes that I told you, that I really have that much much insight about.
Question here.
Hi, Professor. I was just wondering your opinion on the fact that there's been some quite persuasive arguments over political strategies, particularly in the US, creating a climate of fear towards their own ends to get an increased domestic political support. I was just wondering, do you see that in some way contradicts any intentional or otherwise attempt to cook the books, as you said earlier on reducing the numbers of terrorist attacks?
That was my initial reaction. And you know, when you see the trend in the glossy charts going down, and then you see the harder numbers or the harder information in the back of the report showing the opposite trend, you really wonder. I think in the case that I discussed, it really was incompetence. Now, to the extent that there were political motivations, I think if the incompetence caused mistakes in the opposite direction, somebody in the administration would have said, this can't be true, double check it. What was kind of remarkable to me, and this is kind of what John Stewart was tapping into, all you have to do is watch CNN to see that there's been an increase in terrorism. You know, it doesn't take that much sophistication. So you really wonder what kind of a bubble that Richard Armitage and Kofor Black were in to take those charts at face value. Kofor Black was replaced afterwards as the main terrorism official at the State Department. I don't know if it was related to this particular episode, although I wouldn't be surprised if it was. So in that instance, I think it really had to do with incompetence. And I think that the public should demand more from the government. That you know, in the U.S., if you go through the dollars, you go through the budget, and you see what is it that we've changed, and I suspect it's similar in the U.K., although not as extreme. How much of the public treasury are we spending because of this major initiative in the war on terrorism? And then, well, how are we doing? How are we going to figure out whether we're effective or not, whether we have the right strategy, or maybe our strategy's backfiring? There's really no way to do it, and it's kind of amazing to me the attitude towards the statistics in this instance. That's certainly not the way we do economic policy, where we pay very close attention to GDP growth, and we pay close attention to inflation and to unemployment. And you know, maybe it's in the interest of some of the people in power to not want to collect the data, but I think it's more a mindset that statistics are not so important. Statistics is kind of a dry subject. So that to me, you know, sometimes I call this a faith-based policy. They have faith that these are the right strategies, and you don't need to monitor to see how it's working.
Right, I think we better have the last question. This one back there. Can you get the mic?
I just wanted to go back to the media topic really fast. I was wondering, do you have any data as to the effectiveness of terrorism? Because it's my personal view, I guess, feel free to disagree, that terrorism is not effective, and that the terrorism that makes it into the media really has no effect. You know, I can't think of any instance where terrorism by itself has ever achieved, you know, national liberation. Certainly it's played some role, some small role in certain national liberations, but Northern Ireland's not free, Palestine's still not free. It seems that most of the time terrorism, even though it's publicized, doesn't really create any fear. Two ridership hasn't gone down very much in in London, I wouldn't think. It doesn't seem to be that people are running scared from terrorism. So do you really think that there is a CNN effect with terrorism? Do you think that that getting these things into the media and having people, you know, blow up coffee shops in the morning is really very much more effective than other forms of terrorism? Do you have economic, you know, data or any other data that would support
Let me answer that. There's a debate, which I'm certainly no expert on the effectiveness of terrorism. My interpretation is that you get terrorism when there are not alternatives. If a movement was strong enough to have a full-fledged civil war, it would wage a full-fledged civil war. So in that sense, I think you tend to get terrorism in situations where the odds are against the group that's perpetrating the terrorist acts. A really good example, I think, is between Israel and the West Bank and Gaza Strip, where Israel just militarily dominates. The idea of a kind of a full-fledged civil war just was never going to be in the cards. I think you could go back historically and see some episodes, some cases where terrorism did achieve the goals or move the ball forward for the terrorist organizations. I think you could probably say that about the formation of the State of Israel. From what I read, today's George Washington's birthday, so I can say this again. You know, if you read some of the writings in Britain at the end of the 18th century, George Washington was called a terrorist. So, you know, I think it depends a bit on how one defines terrorism. I suspect that if you go back, when historians go back and they look at September 11th, I think they'll say that al-Qaeda was more successful than they had actually hoped for. You know, if you look at what they achieved in terms of getting the U.S. in a position where we invade Iraq, which personally I don't think is in the United States' interests or the world's interest, where we make fundamental changes at home towards our civil liberties, where we become more of a target for outrage around the world. It's hard for me to imagine what it was that Osama bin Laden was hoping to accomplish that he didn't, you know, other than getting the U.S. out of Saudi Arabia, which he hasn't achieved, at least not yet. So I think you have to say, do the terrorists kind of advance their agenda? And they have different agendas. Sometimes the agenda is to try to recruit more people. And if that's the case, then having more publicity on CNN could help with the audience that they want to reach to recruit additional people. So it's not obvious to me that terrorism is always a failure, and it might be that you get terrorism in cases where success is very unlikely because the odds are already overwhelming. That's why dissidents are turning to terrorism as opposed to some other tactic, which I think you also have to factor in.
Well, thank you very much, Alan, for handling the questions so deftly. If I might just add a word based on your last remark, perhaps if Clausewitz were alive today, he might have said, terrorism is the continuation of diplomacy by other means. And this is very striking in the case of Israel, alternate phases of negotiation and intifada. So perhaps that would be a theme for tomorrow, consequences of terrorism. So do all come back. Thank you.
Thank you.